Podcasts of Homegrown are made possible thanks to support from listeners like you. Consider becoming a member of WFPL by calling 502-814-6565 or at the website wfpl.org. Thanks. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
And Bob Hill.
And today on the show, we have Dr. Charles Covell, who's retired down in Florida now, but yep. He was a University of Louisville professor.
Legendary.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, he wrote a book about Lepidoptera of some sort, and I went to the book signing. It was one of the fun days of my life because...
Butterflies.
Yeah, you know, all these people were showing up.
Yeah.
Butterfly freaks were all over the place.
It was an interesting mix of people.
He's an interesting man.
Yeah, so he'll be here with us today talking about slugs and snails. It's certainly been a wet season. Lots of lush foliage out there, damp, cool areas for them to enjoy themselves.
Yep.
So I think I've noticed a lot of babies being born, if you will, in my romaine lettuce heads.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
So, but well, that's okay.
Well, you don't, you know, not the incubator you want.
No. I flick them towards the chickens and they take care of it.
Oh, yeah.
So anyway. And then also we're going to talk about the true lilies, the Lilium genus, Asiatic lilies, you know, Turk's cap, tiger lilies.
Right.
All of them. But Marianne Casey's going to join us. She's in Virginia and she's been involved in the North American Lily Society, the Midwest Lily Society. She's a president of it, in fact. So she'll be able to talk about all the different options there are out there for us in the garden. And I think people will be surprised that there's more than just, you know, the bright orange Asiatic lilies or
It's a great subject because it's more and more popular plant.
It's
easy
great
to grow.
In the summer garden.
Prolific. Mm-hmm. It works well. And like I say, midsummer, nothing else is going on. So we'll get them sorted out and explain them to them.
Good cut flower.
And us.
And us, exactly. Yeah. So that's coming up on Homegrown today. We hope that you'll stick with us. What's going on in your garden, Bob?
Variegation season has kicked in. I've got almost a disease about variegated plants, and I just like them. And in a row, I've got this variegated hedge maple, which is just gorgeous. It's kind of white and green and a little bit of pink in there. Next to my Hikuri Nishiki willow, which has the same problems, or happiness, depending on how you define it.
Yeah, exactly.
Then I've got a variegated ginkgo that's kind of yellow and green, and next to that, I've got a variegated Turkish oak. All these plants in a row underneath a locust freesia, which is kind of a lime-colored yellow.
Uh-huh.
So people walk in there and they either flee in horror.
Or go, oh, my God.
What is
fabulous.
This guy thinking? Yeah. Wow. And so that's
kind of... But you're right. Yeah, they love it or you hate it, the whole variegation thing.
Uh-huh. And I try and keep them all in about 20 square feet or so. So it
so
isn't
it's
too
particularly
much.
Vulgar.
But, yeah, that's true. And this time of summer, you know, midsummer is when they really seem to kick in before because they'll get more muted toward the end of the season. But
so do you think that the variegation's been a better variegation, stronger because of all the rain that
we've
had this
question.
Year?
That's a good question. I think so because it's never been better.
Okay.
And it really hasn't been in... I'm trying to control myself to more 10 or less.
We have a variegated sweet gum.
Oh, yeah.
That this year is more consistently variegated than it's ever been before.
Right.
So I don't, you know.
Yeah, I've got a couple of trees I want to get into. I don't want to get into because it's people will flee in terror.
Yeah.
How about the wish you stay? What's up?
Well, you know, speaking of all the rain, great for some plants, kind of hard on others. Like some of these really heavy rainfalls that we've had in the past couple of weeks. Like shredded my cucumbers. I mean, they've recovered because new foliage was put on. But I went out there and I was like, hey, you know, what happened here? And you can tell it was a shredding effect more from heavy raindrops. And then the wind have knocked over tomato cages, that sort of thing. So it's put a little undue stress on some plants that have been, you know, battered by it all. And then I wanted to give you an update on all those Roma tomatoes I had to pull up.
I mean,
because
we
they were diseased and I wasn't quite sure what it was.
Yeah.
It's been verified. It's not a totally uncommon tomato disease. And we're going to talk about tomato diseases next week. But it's called tobacco mosaic virus. And there are various mosaic viruses. And mosaic, you can see on the foliage where it's kind of mottled, whitish, light yellow, almost variegated. And you will likely see some sort of aphid infestation at some point, in fact, which I talked about, right?
Yep.
Because the vectors that spread the disease, it's a virus, so it gets into the system of the plant because the little sucking insects have spread it, so they have to start sucking on the plant to get it in its system, and then it doesn't grow, and then the foliage is kind of fern-like and pointed, you know, more kind of witch's broomy like.
Mm-hmm.
You can't get rid of it, so your best bet is to pull them up so that somebody doesn't feed on that and then jump on your other plants and infect them. Pulled it up, Bob. No wonder this thing was stunted and hadn't grown an inch since I planted it. It had like hardly any root system whatsoever. You know, so it's like if something's stunted, likely something.
Yeah.
You mean you won't? Don't be surprised.
Right.
When you pull it up and there's like hardly any roots because it just hasn't done what a plant is supposed to do.
Well, sort of a cool spring and then all of a sudden the rain kicked in. Mm-hmm. Maybe it just never had the chance to.
Mm-hmm.
So can you plant in that same area next year, do you think, tomatoes?
Yeah, you can with that particular virus.
Okay.
But you want to make sure that you keep the area like weed free because those little insect vectors that spread it can also, you know, get it from the weeds that are around. And it's relatively weed-free, but the prairie's not too far away, so that could be a little bit of the problem, you know.
Wow, so another hard-earned lesson at Rancho Wishy.
Exactly.
Wow.
But I was you have to be brave, too, because you have to admit defeat and pull up the stuff and get rid of it if that's what needs to be done.
We actually have to confess on the air, we sort of avert our eyes now going past our vegetable garden.
Uh-oh, does it look bad?
Yeah, we spent a couple weeks with other things we were dealing with, and when we got back to it, it looked like El Rancho Wishy, parts of it anyway.
Looked like the prairie, you mean?
So, but we're not giving up.
I mean, like the vegetables plants aren't dead, it's just really weedy, right?
Yeah, weedy and then a little bug eaten, but
okay.
The beets themselves look fine.
Yeah, I wouldn't. Bug eating's not so bad.
No,
really.
Everybody's got to eat.
Yeah, exactly. But you do need to get control of those weeds.
Yeah.
Oh, well, that means I guess I will be bringing things into you after all.
Please.
Okay.
And speaking of large and small spaces, there's a great tour coming up in some small spaces in Old Louisville.
There is indeed. It's the 16th annual Old Louisville Hidden Treasures Garden Tour, and it takes place July 11th. Saturday, and then Sunday, July 12th, from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. They recommend that you go to oldlouisvillegardentour.com to purchase your tickets. If you've got a small space, you can get some really, really good ideas. I mean, even if you have a big space, but you can get some really good ideas.
Yeah, many people complain, my garden's too small, it's too shady in the backyard. Mm-hmm. Go to the Old Louisville Garden Tour and learn what can be done.
Exactly.
It's not just flowers and plants and stuff, it's art. And
yeah.
Ponds and benches and the execution thereof. So it's really great.
Yeah, and there are a lot of old trees down there, so there's a lot of shade. And I suspect there's probably a lot of snails and slugs.
I think so. And certainly snails and slugs are part of this season, particularly this spring. It's been so wet. We've got the guy who can talk all about that. He's former University of Louisville professor and master of bugs and butterflies, Dr. Charles Colvell, who's retired to Florida, where he remains active as a part-time curator of Lepidoptera at the University of Florida's Museum of Natural History. But he's with us today to talk about slugs and snails and what we can do about them, if anything. Dr. Colvell, welcome to Homegrown.
Oh, great to hear your voice and Janine's too.
Thank you.
Just briefly before we get started, catch us up on what you're doing down there. You have legions of fans in Louisville wondering what Dr. Covell's doing in Florida.
Well, in 2004, I was invited to become a curator at a very large collection of moths and butterflies here at the University of Florida. It's part of the Florida Museum of Natural History, and it's called the McGuire Center for Lepidoptera and Biodiversity.
Sounds perfect.
I am one of the curators. That means I take care of organizing and caretaking part of the collection, and I'm in charge of the larger moths, but I do things still with butterflies as well.
And then along the way, you've had time to read some poetry, apparently. So you want to start us off with a poem and perhaps the subject we're going to talk about.
Well, this is related to snails and slugs.
All right.
That'll work.
Which I guess is our topic for today.
Yes, sir.
Les escargots, it's called.
All right.
And it's written by a Milton Bracker.
All right.
My heart doesn't harden at snails in a garden. I'm fond of their leisurely gait. But here at the table, I wish they were able to run like gazelles off my plate.
Very, very good.
That's funny.
So, yes, in some places, escargot is desirable. In other places, it is not. And that would include many people here in Kentucky and in their gardens.
Absolutely.
So, Dr. Covell, what's the difference between snails and slugs, ultimately?
Well, in the classification of the group, starting with the fact that they are mollusks related to clams, oysters, and so forth, then next along the line, they are in the class called the Gastropoda, the gastropods. And then within that, you have a number of families. And these are all snails, but some snails do not have a visible shell externally. If you dissect them or examine them closely, you will see a remnant of a shell on the underside where the foot is.
Yeah.
So really, snails and slugs are really very closely related, but they are just some variants in which the slugs, instead of retreating into a coiled shell like snails do, generally burrow in the ground or hide under boards and logs and stones and things like that.
Or in my lettuce.
Well, they come out and visit your lettuce at night, usually, and then in the daytime, they're hiding in such a place as I have just described.
I see.
It should be very moist, and this is in favor of outbreaks of snails and slugs, but dry weather is conducive to controlling them.
Mm-hmm. Doctor, do you have any sense of how long they've been around and their evolutionary process? Because they seem so soft and squishy, they couldn't possibly survive more than 2 weeks.
Well, as a group, they go back to the Jurassic. That is about 206 down to 144 million years before the present.
Wow.
That's the gastropods. Now, as far as slugs, I don't have any information on how they radiated.
Right.
So can you give me an example of other gastropods?
Well, most sort of the helical shells that you would find at the beach...
Okay, our gastropods. So,
represent okay. Gastropods. And then there are those beautiful unshelled creatures called nudibranchs, which are like sea, they're called sea slugs.
Okay.
And some of them have gorgeous colors.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so if we think about our sort of general garden snail and slug, okay, you mentioned that they're hiding under debris, keeping cool and moist at during the day,
yeah.
And then they come out to feed at night. You know, what's nightlife like for a snail and slug?
Well, of course, like most animals, they have two things on their mind, eating and making more snails, slugs.
Right.
When they come out at night, they can feed on a great variety of vegetation. They're strictly vegetarian. These are the land slugs and snails I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And they move along on the foot, which is a muscular structure, and little wave-like motions of the foot cause them to move along at a snail's pace. And they secrete a layer of slime.
Yeah, I've seen
to
that.
Make it comfy. They put down their own red carpet. And this is how you can tell if there have been snails and slugs around, because they leave that sort of
sure.
rainbow-colored slime trail, which dries up, and that's how you can tell you got a problem if you haven't detected it in other ways.
Uh-huh.
So they go out, and then they find appropriate plants, and most of the ones they will pick on are delicately leaved plants like lettuce. Impatiens is a good choice for
mm-hmm.
them. And then the small sprouts of just about anything.
Mm-hmm.
What they can't eat are things like magnolia leaves and azalea leaves, things of that nature.
Okay.
I think I read somewhere that slugs have teeth, which doesn't seem possible in that slimy mess, but is that true?
Well, not teeth as we consider them, but teeth as you see them in the horror movies about giant squids and giant octopuses, which are also members of the mollusca.
Mm-hmm.
This structure is called a radula, and it is hardened. It's sort of like a double beak that can reach out and chomp, but it's not teeth in the vertebrate sense.
Mm-hmm. So the telltale sign that you've got them, of course, we've got the little red carpet slime trail.
Yeah.
Then we also have the feeding on the foliage. Is it an irregular feeding of the foliage, or is it a perfect sort of feeding on foliage so people can determine what could potentially be snails and slugs?
The feeding pattern, as I have seen it described, is variably sized round or rounded holes mm-hmm. in the leaves. Mm-hmm. It's they don't seem to eat along the edges like caterpillars normally do, and they can be of different sizes. And there are different snails and slugs out there. Some of them invasives from other countries, and others native species.
Mm-hmm. Any particular prey of the snail and slug?
Frogs and toads, some birds, a few beetles, beetle uh-huh. larvae. These would go after the little ones. They develop directly. They don't have a larval form like a caterpillar or something. The little snails and slugs are just much smaller than the grown ones. And it takes, about 2 years for most species that we have in Kentucky to mature and be ready to mate and lay eggs.
And how large do they get? I'm always amazed. I'll see a slug hole on the end of a very thin hosta leaf that's about 2 feet from the center of the plant. It must have taken them like 2 hours to get up there, and then they eat in 2 hours to get back.
Yeah, and by the way, I did see that hostas are among the favorite foods. I didn't mention that earlier. They get to a bit over 2 inches, maybe three. Huh. Depends on the species, again, and how old they are.
Mm-hmm. They make the same long trip every night, up and back.
Yep, they can move right along if they stay at it.
And another thing, we have to talk, of course, about the sex life of the slug, which has got both male and female parts. Fill us in on that.
Well, I watched a video segment online today, and it was one of the most amazing reproductive stories I've ever seen. Two slugs are moving along, and they can detect the chemicals, aromas of the other, and can tell when it's time.
Okay.
And that's trailing will nibble a little on the back end of the lead snail or the lead slug, and I think this particular one was a slug species.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, that's the cue for the leader to head up to some support, like a bush or something, where there's an overhanging branch, and they go up one after the other onto this branch, and then they start entwining one with another.
It's sort of like when I saw two snakes mating, Dr. Covell.
Very much like
amazing.
That. Yeah, I saw black-tail rattlers in Arizona doing that in the middle of the road.
Sounds
brings back a Beatles song to mind. Anyway, they entwine like that, and they're hermaphroditic, which means they have both male and female sex organs. And what happens after they've twined for a while is the male organ, which is a soft white structure, everts from near the back of the head, not from the rear end of the body.
Huh.
That's another story, because snails and their relatives have the insides turned around. That helps them when they live in shells to expel their wastes.
Sure.
There's no rear door on a snail shell.
Yeah.
So anyway, they have this strange body plan, and the male organs of both come out, and then they entwine together.
Huh. Wow.
And then they enlarge and become a white globular mass. And it is then that the sperm are released and collected by the other, and of course I imagine some of their own too. And then all of that is reversed, and the sperms are taken in through that structure into the body, where they come in contact with the eggs that are developing. And then the two slugs will untwine and then plop off the support onto the ground. And this is quite a show that I saw online about slug sex life.
So, Dr. Covell, so both of them will then lay fertilized eggs?
Then they will lay fertilized eggs in the soil, 20 to 100 at a time.
Holy
and
smokes.
Several times during the summer. And the early to late spring is the prime time for reproduction.
Wow. Sounds like...
So what are we going to do when we have a problem with slugs and snails in the garden?
That's my next question.
Hand picking is one of the first things I've seen mentioned in several sources. The trick is to go out on the dampest night you can with a flashlight and pick them up and put them in a can of soapy water, and that will extinguish their lives. Then to go around during the day is a good idea and overturn boards and things like that. And you can actually put such items out there as traps for them.
Mm-hmm.
Even wet bundled newspapers are very good, I'm told.
Sure.
And so you just go around and pick them up during the day. And that can very often do the job very well. Then the next step is to use a deer trap.
I wondered about that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this combines other activities with snail collection. And you would take a pan or maybe a can or a jar and put it in the ground so that the lip is flush with the ground surface.
Mm-hmm.
Then you pour some beer in there, staler it is, the better, and they will come to it. They love the smell of the yeast. You can actually use yeast and water for the same purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And they fall in, and again, that's the end of them. People I've known, and we used to do this back in the days of my daughter's great fear and revulsion of stepping on slugs in the sidewalks of Brighton Drive, where we lived in Louisville for 40 years.
Right.
Uh-huh.
And she heard that you can put salt on them. And you can do that, and that's pretty bad. It causes all the fluids in the body to ooze out, and it makes a mess. And it's not recommended that one use salt around the garden because it, you know, it's toxic.
Exactly.
But
plant.
I think every child should experience sprinkling salt on a slug on a summer night on the sidewalk, don't you?
Then there are poison baits that you can purchase. They're pellets usually. And there are strict guidelines for their use. They should not be used where pets might encounter them. And in some cases, people have said that they really aren't that effective, that these other methods are really adequate and are preferred.
Well, Doctor, do slugs do themselves in? I read somewhere they're pretty combative creatures, which doesn't seem possible either.
Well, the most combat that I saw was that mating experience I described, but I haven't run into anything except the fact that some snails and slugs are definitely carnivorous as opposed to being herbivores. But the ones that we're going to encounter this summer are the ones that are eating hostas and lettuce and other garden plants.
More peaceful.
Well, Doctor, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. It's a delight to have you back on the radio and come back to Louisville anytime.
Great to talk with you, and I should be up in Louisville this coming weekend.
All right.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Dr. Covell.
You're welcome.
Former University of Louisville professor and master of bugs and butterflies, Dr. Charles Covell, spoke to us from his new home in Florida. For more information on snails and slugs, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org.
Coming up, do you know the difference between the 9 divisions of lilies? Marianne Casey does, and she joins us after the break. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL.
Slip sliding away, slip sliding away. You know the nearer your destination, the more you slip sliding away. Slip sliding away, slip sliding away. You know the nearer your destination, the more you slip sliding away.
Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I'm Bob Hill.
And on to, honestly, one of the prettiest parts of the summer garden are the different types of lilies that are out there.
More, and so welcome.
Yeah, and it's something that we've been talking about lately, desiring to understand the genus a little bit better than we do. We just sort of basic Asiatic lilies. So we found Marianne Casey. She is the president of the Mid-Atlantic Lily Society and the chair of advertising and public relations for the North American Lily Society. She's also an accredited lily judge and boasts a collection of lilies in the hundreds at her home where she gardens and lives in Upperville, Virginia. Marianne, welcome to Homegrown, and thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you for inviting me. This is great.
Sure. So how long have lilies been somewhat of an obsessive interest of yours?
A good 10 years.
Yeah.
A good 10 years, and I found that they were just the most colorful and captivating flower in a summer garden.
Mm-hmm.
And over time, I got hooked. And my sister suggested I try growing a few, and for the same reasons, they were just great no matter what you wanted to do with them. They're mm-hmm. versatile in arrangements and just great in the cutting garden. And so I succumbed, and I now have a very large quantity of lilies in a small area, and it's just heavenly this time of year.
Uh-huh. Great. Okay, so the term lily, I think, because this was somewhat of a conversation you and I had earlier, you know, you wanted to make sure we wanted to talk about the Lilium genus,
yes.
The true lilies, not daylilies or whatever, because that term is used, lily of the Nile, I think is what, Agapanthus, mm-hmm. Lily of the Valley, blackberry lilies, trout lilies, none of those are true lilies. So is there some sort of history to that word lily? Do you know what I mean? That kind of makes it so useful as a description for so many plants.
I think that has to do with the plant resembling the lilies of the true genus.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, usually they have a tall stem. They might have a petaled flower that's out-facing or down-facing or resembles a Turk cap. And perhaps that's where the lily type of flower mm-hmm. came to be thought of as a blackberry lily
almost.
Or something.
Yeah.
And usually there's a couple of leaves on either side,
mm-hmm.
and again, people might confuse that for something in the lily family, because lilies typically are tall,
mm-hmm.
slender plants, and the flowers are at the top, the inflorescence, and the bottom part of the plant is the foliage and the stem.
Mm-hmm. So let's describe the true lily genus then. Can you break down the details of the various species that you can recommend for gardeners, but what makes a lily a lily? A true lily.
Well, the genus, the Lilium genus, is mm-hmm. part of the Liliaceae family.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think for a moment about the day lilies, they're actually part of the Hemerocallis genus, mm-hmm. or the family Hemerocallidaceae, I believe is the way they pronounce it. So there's two families, two upper branches, and then you're coming down to the different characteristics between the day lilies and the lilies or any other plant you have. Now, with the lilies, the discerning factor is the bulb.
Okay.
A true lily has a scaly bulb. It's usually concentric in form, but there are also other types of lily bulbs that are rhizomatous or stoloniferous. And their bulbs underground, they're scaly, mm-hmm. but they're connected by a little runner,
okay.
and they spread out through an area that way. So it's the bulb that is the key to determining whether a lily is of the Lilium genus or another.
Okay.
Day lilies have more of a tuberous.
Marianne, were they native to? Give us some history of the plant and who first collected it.
Well, they're native to the northern hemisphere. Lilies are native to Canada, Asia, China, Japan, Asian territories, all the way from the very far north and all the way down to probably the Philippines. That's about as far as you're going to find some species. And that's what's so incredible about this genus. The lily bulbs can survive, meaning over winter, as far north as zone 1 or 2 in the USDA categories, and then to a subtropic temperature too. It just depends on the species.
Mm-hmm.
So there's quite a variation. There's about 110 to 120 known species of lilies.
Mm-hmm. So for you in Virginia and for us in Kentucky, southern Indiana, we've got a whole slew of lilies available to us, you know, in that zone 6-7 sort of reality,
yes.
huh?
Yes, and you'll find that you can grow some of the martigans, that's a particular division within the genus, that is mostly found in Europe and Canada, mm-hmm. but they may not thrive as well here. You have to go to a hybrid that mm-hmm. is a little more heat tolerant. And they cannot grow some of our trumpets because mm-hmm. the trumpets cannot endure as easily the long, cold winter. They can endure some, but not quite the prolonged period that the Canadians have with months of mm-hmm. Cold winter.
Mm-hmm. Is there any name in history that's associated with sort of popularizing lilies in the garden?
Well, in the, I guess it was the late 1800s, there was a seminal work by H.J. Elwes, the monograph of the genus Lilium, mm-hmm. and it included illustrations, and I think that probably captivated or enticed people to start looking at lilies for their garden and their plant collections. And then in the 1900s, I think most of the lilies that we have in our gardens today were brought into notoriety. There's Ernest Henry Wilson, for example, who was mm-hmm. with the Kew Garden and the Royal Academy of Science, and he had contacts at the Arnold Arboretum in Boston. In the early 1900s, he went on many plant expeditions and brought back plants, and then they further categorized them and started testing with them in garden settings. Mm-hmm. And from there, your lily hybridizers, people in the commercial industry, they would start working with them and try to develop hybrids that might be more suitable to garden settings.
So the lilies that I have in my garden are, you know, really tall stalks, multiple flowers, you know, on the top.
Mm-hmm. The inflorescence.
Yeah, some have already bloomed that were like short,
yes.
single blooms.
Uh-huh.
And now they're really tall ones with the multiple inflorescence are blooming. So what's what in my garden? Because I'm not really sure. They're, you know, trumpet lilies or Asiatic lilies. I don't really know what's out there.
Sure. The Asiatic lilies in our area are typically the ones that bloom first.
Okay.
And any foundation Asiatic species, Davidii, Concolor. And for the northerners, the Mardigans would be the first to bloom first. So the easiest way I look at it, if I had a collection of lilies out there and I didn't know what they were, mm-hmm. I would probably start to think, okay, these are in bloom, these are Asiatics.
Okay.
The Mardigans have already come and gone. And after the Asiatics, the trumpets will come into bloom. And they might be a little bit taller.
Mm-hmm.
It depends.
These are really tall, yeah.
Right. And then you also concurrently might have an interdivisional cross, which is an Asiatic cross with a trumpet.
Okay.
They bloom about the same time. Following the trumpets will be the another interdivisional. It's quite popular now, the Oriental trumpets. And they get very tall, and they bloom through July. And then they're followed by the Orientals and the L. Henryi types of trumpets.
Mm-hmm.
So the Orientals will be last, and the season comes to a sad close.
For everything.
The last L. Henryi bloom
uh-huh.
fades and drops from the plant.
Uh-huh.
Well, tell us some about the fabled stargazer, which everybody seems to have. It's got an interesting history. Where does that fall in these categories? And talk about that.
It's an Oriental lily, and yes, indeed, it is a hybrid of the Lilium speciosum, and it was developed for the cut flower trade and for commercial purposes because it has that incredible size and incredible fragrance. But it also has that ability to hold its bloom for a long time. And when you cut that stem for shipping, the bud will not brown as easily as some of the other cultivars. That's one of the reasons why a hybridizer will look at that characteristic, is they want them to be able to ship.
Mm-hmm.
Those LAs and certain Orientals have to be tough enough to withstand the transport.
So when it comes to all the, my understanding is there's about 9 divisions of
mm-hmm.
lilies.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we kind of sort through the different visual experiences that lilies can offer?
Right. And it's a good question. It's getting difficult from a competition standpoint how to classify
mm-hmm.
some of these things. But if you start with your foundation species, there would be, let's just say, three or four species that gave rise to the Asiatic division,
mm-hmm.
a different three or four species that gave rise to the trumpet division, and, you know, likewise for the Oriental division and the Mardigan division. Within each division, the lilies are fairly similar,
okay.
meaning they will have the same leaf pattern. For example, Mardigan lilies have a whorled leaf pattern versus an Asiatic that will have an alternating leaf pattern. And again, the succession of the bloom time is a key factor
okay.
in that. Your Mardigans will bloom first.
The Asiatic,
in the season, then the Asiatics,
okay.
then the trumpets, and then your interdivisionals tend to be in there, the LAs that are so popular now and the OTs.
Okay.
And then as you move later into the summer, towards the end of July, middle of July, end of July, you'll have the L. Henryi hybrids and the Orientals coming into bloom.
And that's good information, because in that way people will be able to buy a selection of and get them through the entire summer.
Yes, I have lilies blooming from about the second or third week in May until the middle of September.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
So is there a perfect garden environment culture for lilies?
Well, there is. But they will tolerate a lot.
Okay, good.
But they do like, I'm sure you've heard this, their feet in the shade and their head in the sun.
Ah.
And I have found that to be very true, and they do like that. They love drainage, and if you're going to have a lily persist, you really have to pay a little attention to your drainage. Sometimes you can pop them right in the ground in a good spot and never have to think twice. But here in Virginia, we have this heavy clay soil. I have just plop them in the soil and they're fine.
Mm-hmm.
But I've also cultivated a little bit to break that soil up and to introduce a little bit of bark or sand or something like that to
mm-hmm.
make it friable. Their root systems, briefly, they have two sets of roots. One go down into the soil from the bottom of the bulb, and then another set, when the plant emerges, forms around the surface soil, and that is to stabilize the plant. So there's a couple of reasons why that soil has to be friable. Those roots have to be able to expand in
sure.
both directions, but it's also the bulb. The bulb cannot take a whole lot of standing moisture. The other saying that I love, that I find to be true, is you can bake a lily, but you cannot boil it.
I gotcha. Yeah,
yeah,
sure.
That's true.
So you got to make sure it's well-drained.
Yeah.
Right.
How about insects and diseases? What to look for?
The most common pets are aphids and slugs,
mm-hmm.
and fortunately they're both easy to manage. There is, unfortunately, a lily leaf beetle that's causing some havoc right now. It's making its way across Canada, and about 10 years ago, it all but stopped lily growing in New England, and they've now got that under control with three types of European wasps.
Mm-hmm.
Natural predator, and it seems to be balancing out. We haven't really seen much of it here in the South, which is good, but that's sort of taking care of itself.
Mm-hmm.
My lilies seem to be very prolific. When and how do you divide and things like that?
About every 3 years, if you scratch the soil a little bit, you might see some little bulblets and leaf shoots coming up.
Mm-hmm.
You could pluck those off and just move them over, or even toss them out if you have enough lilies. But about 4 to 5 years, you might want to actually uplift the whole clump and do a division. And they're so easy to divide. They almost break apart. You'll see where the divide will occur naturally, and you just break it apart.
Mm-hmm.
And then you'll have lilies to give to the neighbors and your children. And
are they edible?
Yes, some of them are. I believe it's the Davidii, Lilium Davidii, that is edible. And I understand that they still cultivate them in some parts of China today to eat.
Hmm.
And I went to one convention where they were talking about a past convention where they made an hors d'oeuvre with lilies.
Cool.
And at some point, I'm hoping somebody will bring that recipe so we can try it.
Yeah, it sounds sacrilegious, though.
It does.
Boy.
Oh, I think it sounds fabulous.
Yeah.
That could be something that you all can do for the 2010 Lily Show.
Yes,
that's
our annual
yeah.
Lily Show and convention. It's going to be in Pittsburgh,
mm-hmm.
actually in Mars, Pennsylvania, and It's a fantastic outing. We have people coming from all over the world. It sounds like a lot, but there's usually about 200 people that attend, and we're a diverse group. Some are researchers, some mm-hmm. are commercial growers, others are hobbyists like myself, mm-hmm. some are hybridizers. It's just a wonderful group, and we get together and show lilies, show pictures of lilies, talk about lilies, and have some seminars and whatnot on different topics.
Yeah, before we go, can you give us some names maybe of some lilies that people might try beginning in May through September by their cultivar names? So look for them in the catalogs and so forth.
Sure. And you can certainly use the internet, and if you Google these names, you'll probably find a lily supplier, a specialty lily supplier. But the Mardigan, if you're going to try one in our area, would be a hybrid called Terrace City.
Uh-huh.
Or the Lilium dalhansonii, and those are two good Mardigans to try. Some any of the Asiatics, just choose by color. Some of the ones that I like are taller with longer pedicels. There's a deep red Morden butterfly, Morden, named after one of the Canadian plant research stations. That's a fantastic lily. And if you're looking for something with a later bloom, I don't really have a favorite trumpet, but there are the OT's Northern Carillon or Silk Road.
And when you say OT, you mean the Oriental Trumpet Combo,
yes,
right?
Yes, that's okay. The interdivisional that's mm-hmm. become so popular. They do get very tall, and but they also have
though.
20 to 30 blooms,
wow.
And the blooms are huge. They'll
get to
be 4 or 5 inches across.
This is nature's perfect plant, isn't it?
It really is.
It's fabulous. I'm so excited. Thank you, Mary Ann.
Sure.
Uh-huh. Mary Ann Casey is the president of the Mid-Atlantic Lily Society and the chair of advertising and public relations for the North American Lily Society. She lives and grows lilies in Upperville, Virginia. And, of course, for more information on lilies and the various societies, you can go to our website at WFPL.org.
Coming up next, a few listener questions and another chapter in Bob's Fabulous Plant Stories. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL.
Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I'm Bob Hill.
This is an email question from Christina Vincent, Bob. And
yep.
She says, over the 20 years or so, she's probably really frustrated by now because she's been trying to figure out what this tree is for 20 years. Over the 20 years or so, I have come across a tree that is very different. At one time, I was told it was a devil's cane, but when I looked it up on the internet, it was not the same tree. The trees that she's seen are around 15 to 20 feet tall, and the main feature, which is the reason I like them so much, are the branches. They look like a dish rag when it's been wrung tight. In other words, the limbs are twisted.
Good description.
It also kind of reminds me of a candy cane without the colors. So she's wondering if we have any ideas. And it's funny because she says somebody told her it was a devil's cane. And it's funny how people can kind of like mix up
right. One
thing with another thing.
Yeah, devil's walking stick and a Harry Lauder
walking stick. Exactly.
And my best guess is the Harry Lauder walking stick, there actually was a Harry Lauder too. He was a
mm-hmm.
real person. And
yeah.
Pretty sure that's what it is.
Yeah. So Harry Lauder walking stick.
Yeah.
But the botanical name is Corallus avellana, A-V-E-L-L-A-N-A. So, and
yeah.
Corallus is like a hazel. Corylus, Corylus avellana contorta, basically. So a contorted filbert.
Yeah.
But I'm pretty sure that's what it is as well, Bob.
Next question is from a Jay Cahill. Question, actually two questions.
Mm-hmm.
I have a clematis that's growing like crazy, capital C, but only has a few large blooms each year. They're usually close to the ground. It is located in an area that gets only a few hours of direct sun each day. So anything I can do to get more blooms? We have different thoughts
yeah.
on this one.
Well,
your guess
it could be a bunch of different things,
yeah.
Kind of depending on what kind it is, right, Bob?
Right, exactly. Yeah, there are some clematis you would not prune. It depends when you prune them. If you prune them at the wrong time,
mm-hmm.
you're cutting off the next year's blooms.
Mm-hmm.
Some you want to cut back in the spring, and some you don't cut back in the spring,
mm-hmm.
basically.
Just after they finish blooming
yeah,
is really the best time to do it.
Sounds like it could be that if he's pruned at the wrong time, That's why the blooms are staying low. It's blooming on last year's growth, but the new growth doesn't put out the blooms. That's just one.
It's possible.
Yeah.
And also, most clematis are going to like more sun, at least 6 hours of sun to bloom well. The sweet autumn clematis, the one with the tiny little white flowers, that one blooms well in the shade.
Right.
But most of the other large flowering varieties don't. So here's the thing. Pay attention to when it does bloom. And if it blooms earlier in the spring, you'll want to prune it right after it finishes blooming because it blooms on that old, you know, the growth basically from this season. If it blooms sporadically throughout the summer, kind of like the traditional purple Jack Manny, that blooms on new growth, so you don't have to be as careful about when you prune it. So that's always a good indication when it when it blooms will give you an idea of when you need to prune it. And if you don't need to prune it at all, don't prune
exactly.
it at all.
That's my next answer. Don't prune it for a whole year and see what happens. If you get more blooms higher up, then you know what the problem was.
Second part of his question, several daylilies that are getting too big for the area, can I separate and transplant them now, or do I need to wait until they die back?
Well, as usual, you can wait. I mean, you should wait. If you have to move them now, then move them. Daylilies are pretty tough. But I, you know, I recommend wait until they're done blooming, if you can.
Because most daylily people usually dig and divide, you know, especially for sale purposes, in July, because that's, you know, when they're finished blooming and when they're starting to sort of wind down a little bit. So that's a safe time to do it as well. But as Bob said, you can do it anytime. You need to if you have to, kind of thing.
If you have a heavy question for Bob or Janine, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org. Email us at homegrown@WFPL.org or call us at 814-8246.
All right, Bob, it is a plant story day. What do you have?
A question from Miss Wishy.
A question?
Yeah, because you're the Latin person here.
All right.
If I mentioned to you Cludrastis Kentuckia, what would you think?
Yellowwood.
Kentucky Yellowwood. Yeah.
Okay.
You're good.
I thought he was going to trick me like he always
tries to trick me. No, that was, I just wanted to affirm your expertise in all matters Latin.
Well, it is one of my favorite trees.
Me too.
Okay.
It's so named because the wood, the freshly cut wood, the heartwood is a muted yellow. You've seen that.
I saw after the storm broke off a bunch of branches.
Oh, yeah. We'll get to that.
Okay.
It will yield a yellow dye. It was used for furniture and gunstock back in the day and maybe still be now. It's a little known and not much used tree for three pretty good reasons. One, the reputation for its limbs, which can quickly grow in narrow crotches, as it does. You know, it goes upright and kind of wild all over the place. The name derivation, cludros, comes from the Greek cladros, meaning branch, and thrastos, meaning fragile. Fragile branch.
It wasn't that fragile.
No, the ice storm, mine did very well.
Yeah, I mean, some branches broke out, but it wasn't that fragile. It was retrievable, or, you know, restorable, rather.
And the other mark against it, it doesn't always bloom well every year.
It's supposed to bloom every other year, and I think that's just a fabulous thing about the tree.
That's what I was going to say. I like that because there's some mystery to it. I like that, And if you prune it and take care of it and get rid of those bad crotches, it's a beautiful gray bark, gets about 30 feet tall, and the flowers are like wisteria.
Oh, they're beautiful.
Kind of dangly and white and fragrant. And
fabulous.
It is kind of fun to see if it'll bloom that year or not. There's also a cultivar named Perkins Pink, which I have as pink, kind of pinkish flowers, so it's true. It's a pretty tough tree, often used along roads and interesting yards. The interesting thing beyond that is if you want to see a big bunch of them, go to the Yellowwood State Forest in Brown County, Indiana.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh, how about that when they're all blooming?
Yes, there's about a 200-acre patch of those things.
Wow.
In Indiana.
Wow.
The largest yellowwood we know of is in Spring Grove Cemetery in Cincinnati, Ohio, 60 feet tall.
Interesting.
And the mystery, and I looked all over the place trying to find exactly who named it the Kentucky Yellowwood. I wanted to know. I couldn't find out.
Sorry.
But I got a poem.
All right, good.
Oh, it remains such a wonderful mystery to me. This naming of the Kentucky Yellowwood tree, was it someone who had wandered the wilderness wide, or someone sitting in London who had stayed inside? That the Greeks were involved, there's a very good chance. They saw the worst of the tree, its fragile branch. Yet the Yellowwood tree has so much more to say, flowers, fragrance, and bark, a natural bouquet. And here's the other question all gardeners should ponder. The tree's named for Kentucky, but its park's way up yonder. In Indiana, God help us, where the tall corn grows, acres of yellowwood grow in elegant repose. And the biggest grows in Ohio, almost 60 feet tall. So who knows what Kentuckians should make of that all?
That's right. And somebody needs to beat all these people
Find
everywhere.
Out
exactly.
Who named the Kentucky Yellowwood
Yeah,
tree?
Exactly.
Daniel Boone, maybe.
Maybe. All right. Well, that ends another edition of Homegrown. Next week on the show, Bob, we're going to sort through some tomatoes, diseases, among other things. Did you know that there's nearly like 60 different things that could go wrong with your tomatoes?
At least.
We won't cover all of those, but we will cover some of them.
Homegrown is produced by the always upright Brad Yost in the studios of WFPL. I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishey. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.